From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC Action. I'm filling in for Tony Perkins today. It is Friday, and there is no shortage of things to talk about. We hope your week was a good one. But we start with a piece of legislation in our first block that presents not only challenges to the faithful among us who adhere to Orthodox beliefs in their religion, but to those who do not want to be shell-shocked by the whole-cloth addition of separate categories in federal civil rights legislation. We'll have a discussion about why the Equality Act, inaptly named, by the way, is a terrible idea, with our friend Republican Congresswoman Debbie Lesko of Arizona. In my second segment, Dr. Anna Samuel joins me to discuss her provocative and compelling column in the public discourse, entitled A Message to Mayor Pete from a Latina Mama. Don't force your sexual ideology on me and my children. I can't wait to talk to her. And at the bottom of the hour, a real treat. Dr. James Dobson of Family Talk Radio, heard on 1,200 stations nationwide, nationally recognized psychologist and the author of more than 30 books, joins me to talk about the upcoming National Day of Prayer on Thursday, May 2nd. In my final segment, Rizgard Legutko, author of The Demon in Democracy, Totalitarian Temptations in Free Society, a member of European Parliament, a statesman, and a political theorist, joins me to discuss being disinvited to speak at Middlebury College. Yes, the Middlebury College that also mobbed around Charles Murray when he came to speak last year, after he flew in all the way from Poland to speak. So what made a lecture on his book, The Demon in Democracy, so terribly controversial? Well, join us at 5:42 to find out. As a reminder, you can visit our podcast, TonyPerkins.com. For more information on our guests and the resources we discuss here today, be sure to share the podcast with friends and family. You can follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry, where we discuss today's articles and the happenings in Washington, D.C. Well, last month, Democrats introduced the Equality Act of 2019. This was their sacred cow, the piece of legislation that Nancy Pelosi herself attempted to introduce in 2015 but did not pass, and tried again with new iterations in 2019. This ill-titled bill would modify existing civil rights legislation to ban discrimination against people who identify as homosexual and transgender in all aspects of employment, housing, public accommodation, jury service, education, federal programs, and credit lending. Now, this may sound like a good idea at first blush, but there are serious problems with the ill-titled Equality Act of 2019. The central is that the Equality Act overrides and effectively completely guts the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, as you may have heard it responded to. That statute which protects religious liberty could no longer be used within a civil rights context. Joining me to discuss this in greater depth is Republican Congresswoman Debbie Lesko, who is the representative for the 8th Congressional District in Arizona, serves on the House Homeland Security Committee, the Rules Committee, and the House Judiciary Committee. Congresswoman Lesko, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
So I don't quite know where to begin with the many, many problems in this piece of federal legislation. We could take so many angles in discussing it. So let me just start with a quote. Kristen Wagoner, Senior Vice President of Alliance Defending Freedom, said this about the Equality Act. It would undermine the fundamental freedoms of speech, religion, and conscience that the First Amendment guarantees for every citizen. That's not exactly hyperbole, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, this so-called Equality Act really discriminates against women and girls. And I want to protect women and girls. And so this bill would prohibit, under federal law, in all circumstances, any acknowledgement of the reality of biological sex. So basically, it would allow anyone at any time to declare that he or she is a member of the opposite sex, commonly called gender fluid, and then it would require every entity that receives any federal funding, which could be K through 12 schools, colleges, all the health plans, to accept the view that there is no such thing as biological sex. And the reason that that is dangerous and actually discriminates against women is that it would require doctors and insurance companies to deliver hormone drugs and sex change operations to young girls, young women who may be confused in the teenage years. And this is very dangerous stuff and very radical what the Democrats are doing here.
And it cannot be overstated that this is truly a whole cloth revision and adoption of these, what I would call sort of super protected SOGI categories. And by SOGI, we mean sexual orientation and gender identity, elevating them to more protected statuses than would originally be protected, for example, by the Constitution that enshrines the notion of our ability to practice our religious liberty as we see fit. In fact, some people have called this bill Orwellian because it is so sweeping. It is so fundamentally transformative. In fact, it would make almost 10 different federal laws. And we're talking the stalwarts, the highest collection of what we know to be our civil rights protections, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Civil Rights Act of 68, the Fair Housing Act, the Congressional Accountability Act, and more. There are 60 amendments that would be enshrined to 10 different federal laws, elevating the notion of gender identity, who you believe yourself to be, regardless of what your biology says, to the same category as, for example, race, gender, age, national origin. These are immutable, inviolable characteristics, the ones upon which the entire archetype of our civil rights framework was formed. And now we bring alongside SOGI protections. In fact, we have friends at the Heritage Foundation who recently held a panel, and Monica Burke of the Heritage Foundation, when they discussed the Equality Act, discussed a Virginia high school teacher named Peter Vlaming who lost his job for refusing to use masculine pronouns in referring to a female student who believed she was a boy. Now, the school still considered this a violation of its anti-discrimination policy, which means this is getting pretty crazy. And now we are dealing with state levels, but state level legislation we manage through the states, through enacting good legislative measures, through electing good state judges, through electing good state legislators. But what Nancy Pelosi does is she wants to elevate this to federal legislation, which leads us with this entire detritus of what would ordinarily have been good decisions. Like, for example, our friend Jack Phillips in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, the Civil Rights Commission in Colorado would have won. His religion be hanged. What we're looking at is federal and private employers facing costly lawsuits if they fail to implement strict preferred pronouns. Employees could be disciplined. Business owners could be disciplined. Adoption agencies could be disciplined. More and more examples we see stacking up incrementally. And what this would do is take all of those state level examples and make sure that in every circumstance, your religious freedom would not prevail. So,
yeah,
to me, To me, it sounds downright nutty.
Well, I agree with you. What you're saying is absolutely accurate. We're basically protecting one class of people over another class of people. And in the instance of a man who identifies as a woman, you are, I believe, discriminating against the women, because now you're going to have no women separated sports, no girl sports, because you're going to allow guys in women's sports. And this is not fair to the women. And so we have heard cases from parents that are just at their wit's end. I mean, some of these states have gone overboard and basically said, if, let's say you're a confused teenager girl, and all of a sudden you see on social media that, oh, maybe your problem is that you're really a boy. Well, what is happening is they're saying, okay, you have to just believe this adolescent, and the doctors and the parents have to go along with it. And if the parents don't go along with hormone therapy, we're going to charge them with child abuse. I mean, this is insanity, and I want everyone to know, and I'm so thankful that you are talking about this, because we need to educate everyone out there what these liberals are doing. It is so radical. It will forever change the future of our nation.
I am so glad to hear you say that, and we are so glad to be able to bring this up. We are hopeful that it will not pass in the Senate, but stranger things have happened, and we know that's the next logical step. But going back to this issue of parental rights, as a mom yourself, and I also am a mom, studies show that 80% to 90% of children no longer experience gender dysphoria after puberty. So again, what you're doing is you're stripping these families of the ability to give their children the care that they need in these particular situations by virtue of the social engineering of a hard left, progressive, Democratic majority. And to me, it's absolutely stymieing. So for our listeners who are thinking about this now, who I hope understand the danger that this legislation proposes, what can you recommend them to do?
Well, I recommend that they talk to everyone they know about it and say what the Democrat majority is trying to push through the House and through our society. In fact, I had a faith roundtable in Arizona yesterday, and I met with several faith leaders, and I'm encouraging them to talk about this issue with their parishioners, because most people don't know anything about this. They don't know what is happening. They don't know what the Democrats are trying to do, what the liberals are trying to do. And when I have talked about this publicly to different groups of people, and they are just shocked. And they're like, certainly that's not going to pass, is it? And I said, it definitely is going to pass in the House of Representatives, because all of the Democrats support it. Now, and that's why elections make a difference.
Yes, they do. Congressman Debbie Lesko of Arizona has been my excellent guest today. Call your representatives, call your senators, express your concerns about the Equality Act. You are listening to Washington Watch. Dr. Anna Samuel joins me next to discuss a message to Mayor Pete.
When you look at what is going on in our country and culture today, do you often ask, what can I do? Well, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on October 11th through 13th in Washington, D.C., and join thousands of Americans just like you who want to change the culture in a way that human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers include President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary Mike Pompeo, Kirk Cameron, Dana Loesch, and Ben Carson. In addition, there will be opportunities to meet with organizations and attendees that share a Christian worldview, and informational sessions focused on the topics of life, religious liberty, the LGBT movement, national security, the realities of socialism, and more. On October 11th through 13th, stand with thousands of Values voters to restore our great nation. Registration is now open. Don't miss the early bird price of $99. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Happy birthday. In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy birthday, dear.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Well, I am so excited about today's lineup. We have saved some of the most excellent guests for last, and I have a personal interest in my next guest. I already feel as if I know her because of what she's written. Dr. Anna Samuel, when I first read her column, well, I just knew that I wanted to have her on the radio show, published at thepublicdiscourse.com, which is the journal of the Witherspoon Institute. She wrote a piece entitled "A Message to Mayor Pete from a Latina Mama: Don't Force Your Sexual Ideology on Me and My Children." Dr. Samuel is the daughter of Mexican immigrants, the wife of an Argentine immigrant, and the mother of six amazing children. She completed her undergraduate studies at Princeton and received her doctorate from Notre Dame before becoming a founding member and academic director of Kennevox. Dr. Samuel, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I was so encouraged and I was emboldened by your piece in the public discourse because you took an angle on a very hot button topic on the tweet, perhaps heard around the world, that utilized your angle as a mother to present exactly why his response was wrong. And for those who are listening, let me set the stage. Mayor Pete Buttigieg tweeted, "People will often be polite to you in person while advancing policies that harm you and your family. You will be polite to them in turn, but you need not stand for such harms. Instead, you push back honestly and empathetically." So it goes in the public square. But you write that the mayor, who's in a same-sex marriage, is saying in subtext that anyone who refuses to cheer for same-sex marriage or support the left's sexual ideology is a bigot, someone who is out to harm Mayor Pete and his family. So you also said, "Mayor Pete, it cuts both ways." This part I found most compelling in your article. What did you mean by "it cuts both ways"?
Well, I wanted to concede first that there are a lot of same-sex couples who do feel like people are out to get them. So I didn't want to question that, but he really needs to understand the way in which their side is also quite intolerant of mothers and families like mine. And so I really wanted to just make that point to start off.
Give some examples, and you reference these in your piece, about how children are being indoctrinated with a leftist sexual ideology. And you provided some excellent examples in different contexts specifically related to children. What are some of those examples?
Yes, I find the most worrisome areas to be in the public schools. In New Jersey, which is my home state, we have a pretty far left agenda now. It's getting closer and closer to the degree that the Californians have. And in my area, the reading assignments from the language arts curriculum ask children in eighth grade, what is heteronormativity and how is it harmful? Now, this is part of the language arts curriculum, right? It's not something you can opt out of. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tell my husband, imagine if that word heteronormativity was said homosexuality. What if the reading assignment was, what is homosexuality and how is it harmful? The left would be up in arms if that were the question, right? But because it's on us, it's perfectly allowed. That was one example. I also pointed out the sex education classes. There are some school boards that still allow some really incredible sex ed classes in which topics are preached about teaching kids in high school, you know, what masturbation is, how to use the condom, outer course, oral stimulation, rectal intercourse. And a lot of times these lessons are delivered with a kind of crass Saturday night type of humor. Mm-hmm. And a lot of parents find this to be very flippant, not really taking the subject seriously and talking to the students about the long-term mental and physical risks of those actions. And in addition, you know, I also was talking as a Latina because I'm very concerned about the Hispanic community and the other more vulnerable members of the public schools, the ones who might not be fluent in English. The ones who can't opt out their children from these schools because they don't have the money to put them in private schools. And they don't really detect all the time what exactly their kids are being taught in the language arts or the history class because they're working two jobs to keep food on the table, right? So I'm extremely concerned about a lot of these families that have traditional family values, but who don't necessarily know what's going on. Nobody's telling them. And yet they would be horrified, and they often are horrified when their kids tell them what they learned at school that day.
I have three children of my own in public school, and I can tell you we are also navigating this landmine. Though heretofore, I have three kids who are annoyed with me because I am that mother, right? The one that comes in to examine the curriculum, the one that wants to meet with school educators, the one that goes through every piece of paper that comes home and asks whether or not the sexual curriculum is going to be made available. So I have also been navigating this landmine. And I will tell you, it is certainly not as bad yet as New Jersey or California, but as specifically concerns the Latino community, I have also heard it said when we've been talking with California experts that they are not even being given the notices both in English and Spanish. And so for predominantly Spanish speakers, they are automatically nixed out of the opportunity to be able to raise their concerns as individuals who subscribe to traditional beliefs.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's really coercive. I mean, they talk so much about tolerance and about making sure we have safe spaces so that everybody can be heard. But it's this rhetoric that is so manipulative because they truly do not allow certain voices to be heard. And they do coerce. There's no opt-out opportunity for a lot of these classes. So we, like you, we need a lot of other mothers to just serve as watchdog kind of organizations that are constantly tapping the shoulders of the school principal. Okay, what are you going to be teaching this year in school in the area of LGBT? We all need to be making, I mean, we have so much on our plates already, right? But this is just too important. We have to prioritize it as mothers, as fathers, as good citizens.
Dr. Samuel, I have been so impressed again by your approach to this very controversial topic and the humanity with which you acknowledge the fact that there are people like Mayor Pete who understand that there are segments of the population that do wish them harm, and yet we maintain our ability to teach our children as we see fit, to instruct them according to the tenets of our faith, to hold fast to our faith, and people like you are writing about this in the most effective, beautiful, eloquent way. So thank you for joining us today on Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, filling in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, a real treat. We have Dr. Dobson of Family Talk, heard nationwide on 1,200 stations, talking about the National Day of Prayer on May 2nd.
Grandpa Jerry, what are you doing?
What? What does it look like I'm doing? I'm sitting on this bench enjoying my tea and reading the news.
You always tell me that I need to stand firm for faith, family, and freedom. Why aren't you standing?
Well, now with this new Stand Firm app, I can sit and stand at the same time. And if you got the Stand Firm app, you could learn something besides that garbage of peddling in public schools. You could listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, where Tony and leaders on the Hill and other culture influencers weigh in on current events. You can read FRC's latest publications and articles responding to what's going on in the news, like this.
Oh.
You can play trivia and earn points for free prizes. You can even access all of FRC's publications directly to sharpen your mind and give you the ability to discern the thoughts and intentions of the heart.
I can be a mind reader?
Kid, that's from the Bible, the richest piece of literature on God's green earth.
Can I see this stand up? Wow, this would keep me informed. Visit frc.org/app to download FRC's Stand Firm app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Washington Watch on this Friday edition. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, filling in for Tony Perkins today. As a reminder, go to our podcast, tonyperkins.com. Follow Tony on Twitter at @TPerkins and me, if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, as we look forward to the National Day of Prayer this coming Thursday, May 2nd, I am more than a little excited to talk to my next guest, who, though he doesn't really need an introduction, I'm going to give one anyway because his CV is quite impressive. In addition to hosting Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk on 1,200 stations, he is the author of more than 30 books dedicated to the preservation of the family, including The New Dare to Discipline, The New Strong-Willed Child, Marriage Under Fire, one of my favorites, Bringing Up Boys, Bringing Up Girls, and most recently, Your Legacy, The Greatest Gift. Dr. Dobson's been active in governmental affairs and has advised 5 U.S. presidents. He earns his Ph.D. from the University of Southern California in the child development field. He is married to Shirley, and they have 2 grown children and 2 grandchildren. The Dobsons reside in Colorado Springs, and I am joined now by Dr. Dobson. Welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah. That was a wonderful introduction. I appreciate it.
Well, I am, as a mom, very excited to be talking to you. So I want to talk today about the National Day of Prayer on March 5th. So just a few weeks ago, the Barna Group released a report entitled What Makes for a Spiritually Vibrant Household? And they listed 3 keys: spiritual practices, defined as praying every day or two, reading the Bible weekly; spiritual conversations, defined as talking about God and faith weekly; and hospitality, which is a welcoming environment for non-family guests. So as a father and grandfather, this is what I would like to know. What has worked in your home related to prayer as a family that is more than the thanks God for the food, which I sometimes get for my kids?
Well, the things that Barna, I guess, just enumerated are outstanding, and I wish all of us lived up to that in all regards. I would add to it, the ultimate priority for those who are parents is the instruction in what it means to love Jesus and know him and be a Christian, and, you know, it changes as the years go by, but that's job one. That's more than anything else is our responsibility to get those kids to heaven. And if you doubt that, look at the sixth chapter of Deuteronomy, where the children of Israel were about to enter the promised land, and Moses was about to die, and he gave his last speech. And when a person says what's on his mind for the last time, it's important, and you know he has given priority to it. And he puts the emphasis in that chapter on conveying to our children what we believe and where we've been and what God has done for us. Mm-hmm. And that is really the theme of my book, Legacy, because everything else matters, but that matters most.
So the theme this year for the National Day of Prayer is taken from John 13:34, which says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, and that you also love one another." So we are a divided nation. You know this. You have advised presidents, and you understand government affairs. We are so divided. How do we best live out the commandment of John 13:34?
That's such an important question, Sarah, and I appreciate you bringing it up, because we are a divided nation. In some ways, it feels to me, from my reading of history, almost like the division that occurred in the Civil War, where there was something akin to hatred for our fellow man and those around us, and it led to 600,000 deaths. I mean, that kind of conflict and that kind of animus between people can lead to violence, and we're not far off that right now. There's conflict everywhere, men against women and women against men. Men are called toxic. That's toxic masculinity today. I mean, when you divide the home right down the middle, and you do have problems. And then, of course, there's conflict between Americans and every form of conflict. I believe the most basic conflict is over spirituality and over the Christian faith. It is hated in some corners, and there is a war to destroy Christian America. So we do need prayer for tolerance for each other and love for each other. But also for us to learn to live together, because that's becoming more and more difficult.
So, Dr. Dobson, if you would be so kind in this minute that we have left, would you lead us in a moment of prayer for the nation?
I would appreciate that. Glad to do so. Heavenly Father, we come to you because we really don't have any other answers. We've tried all of our own solutions, and it really comes back to the fact that you're the God of the universe, and you love us, and you care for us, and you've given a book to tell us how to lead and how to live. And we have not done very well with that. I just ask for your blessing to fall upon this nation. And on the National Day of Prayer, which is coming up, hear the cries of your people. And I pray that you will bring a spirit of repentance and love and acceptance. And we bring especially to you the next generation, which is being twisted and warped. I know that our time is short, but Lord, I just want to thank you for the very privilege of living in a nation where we can gather to pray, and we do so now.
Dr. Dobson has been my guest on Washington Watch. We'll be right back.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away. Get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
When you look at what is going on in our country and culture today, do you often ask, what can I do? Well, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on October 11th through 13th in Washington, D.C., and join thousands of Americans just like you who want to change the culture in a way that human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers include President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary Mike Pompeo, Kirk Cameron, Dana Loesch, and Ben Carson. In addition, there will be opportunities to meet with organizations and attendees that share a Christian worldview, and informational sessions focused on the topics of life, religious liberty, the LGBT movement, national security, the realities of socialism, and more. On October 11th through 13th, stand with thousands of Values voters to restore our great nation. Registration is now open. Don't miss the early bird price of $99. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am your host, Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here. I am filling in for Tony Perkins on this Friday edition, and you have made it to what I believe is a compelling section, not only about the nature of political theory and of governance and of philosophy, asking some of the big questions that profound men and women for generations, but from which there is drawn a kernel of truth in an excellent book I will reference, but indeed how the book was proven true by a circumstance that took place at Middlebury College. Yes, the Middlebury College that also rioted around Charles Murray, the AEI's scholar's appearance, almost exactly 1 year ago. We referenced previously in our last segment, the National Day of Prayer. Let me quickly close that segment out by referring you to nationaldayofprayer.org. Click on events at the top and you can see an event located in your area so that you can participate on May 4th. Well, my next guest, as I mentioned, was invited and summarily disinvited by Middlebury College in Vermont for being of a sort not politically correct enough. Rizard Legutko is the author of The Demon in Democracy, Totalitarian Temptations in Free Society. He is a professor of philosophy at Jagiellonian University in Krakow, Poland, specializing in ancient philosophy and political theory. He has served as the Minister of Education, the Secretary of State in the Chancellery, and the Deputy Speaker of the Senate, and is active in the anti-communist movement in Poland. He is currently a member of the European Parliament and one of the most impressive individuals about which I have ever read. Rizard, welcome to Washington Watch.
Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let me start out with the event that precipitated my discussion with you today, and then I want to get into the meat of the actual book that you wrote, which is more compelling now than it was, I believe, when you originally wrote it. You started hearing when you were invited to Middlebury College, and for which there were arranged travel, and for which you were already planning your trip, that some students and professors were planning to organize protests against your speaking. They accused you, among other things, of being a homophobe, a misogynist, a racist, a sexist, and practically every other ideological sin one can be accused of. So where do you believe their attack came from?
I don't know, as a matter of fact. That wasn't my first visit to an American college, American university. I've been with the book. I've been to Notre Dame, Harvard, Yale, Michigan, Catholic University in Washington, and somehow all these visits were orderly, a routine, I would say. I gave a talk, and there were questions and discussion. The thesis of the book seemed interesting enough to provoke an exchange of views and arguments and counter-arguments. And all of a sudden, on my way to Middlebury, there was this heap of abuse and all possible invectives. Strangely enough, the people who did it didn't read the book, as it turned out. Nobody, nobody among the protesters read the book. But, that might be kind of local color at Middlebury, because as you rightly mentioned, I wasn't the first victim. Fortunately, I wasn't assaulted physically. But that was quite unpleasant. I think somebody must have looked up the internet using Google Translation and found some statements of mine that had very little relation to the book. Well, be it as it may, it provoked a very, very angry reaction. That was the first time in my long academic career that I was prevented from speaking because of my views, and the first time that I was insulted by the students and some of the faculty with the tacit acceptance, I would say, or at least désintéressement on the part of the university authorities.
Now, did the Middlebury president herself, who I understand had disinvited you, did she bother to contact you directly?
She did not, and she didn't try to get in contact with me. She didn't tell me. She didn't try to explain or apologize. I've always considered myself to be a respectable university professor. Also, I'm a European politician coming all the way from Europe, right? So I thought I deserved some kind of explanation and an apology, which I didn't get. Well, it's probably bad manners is also a part of the local color at Middlebury. But there were some nice people I met, the students and professors who made up for the unpleasant side to it. So there are good people everywhere, even at Middlebury.
So before we go any further, I would love to talk about your personal history, because you lived and suffered under communism for decades and fought with the Polish anti-communist movement to abolish it. So now, having lived for two decades under a liberal democracy, you have discovered that these two political systems, and this was a theory originally proposed by your book, The Demon of Democracy, that to some may have seemed an extravagant one, connecting a totalitarian governance system with a left-leaning democracy, increasingly left-leaning democracy, it seemed almost as if there could not be similarities enough to support a thesis to warrant a full book. It was that my perspective was that before I actually read your book, and now I realize that you were truly prescient, that you understood ahead of your time what was going to happen. So explain to our listeners how there are some elements of totalitarianism and liberal democracy that are increasingly similar in their effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, just let me add that for the last 10 years, I've been working in European politics, in the European Parliament, spending most of my time in Belgium, in France, in various European countries. So I have enough evidence, enough experience to make such a judgment. I'm not simply an ivory tower professor. I'm also an active, right, in practical matters. Now, and yes, a couple of years ago, it just struck me as an idea that is worth pursuing, and I did pursue it. To put it in a very brief statement, I think the similarity is, I mean, there are many similarities. You read the book, you know, it has a complex argument. But in a nutshell, it's that both systems, communism and liberal democracy, have a tendency to politicize the entire society, everything. Like in the communist system, everything had to be communist. A family had to be communist. Morality had to be communist. Art, education, everything had to be communist. And then I discovered that in liberal democracy, everything has to be liberal and democratic. Also family, also education, even sex. That's the achievement of liberal democracy, to politicize sex, private life. Under communism, a private life was a shelter, was a place of refuge from the aggression of communist ideology. And in liberal democracy, private life has become an object of politicization, a relation between parents and children, husband and wife. Everything has been a matter of politics, of power. Even this is really the greatest achievement of all, and particularly in the United States, the liberal Democrats managed to politicize toilets. I mean, that is
yes.
Remarkable that even toilets became a matter of ideological dispute. So all this creates a monopoly of one ideology, and everything is interpreted in the light of this ideology. Look at what's going on at the universities, that art, history, literature, anything is interpreted in the light of, well, gender, right? Gender struggle. We have the class struggle in communist. Here we have gender, right? We have men against women, whites against black, heterosexuals against homosexuals, and so on, right? It's the same pattern is applied to every discipline, every aspect of social life. So this creates a stifling atmosphere, and it's become unbearable. I mean, if you do not conform, if you have another opinion, then immediately you become the enemy. Yes, that's another similarity, a profound sense of the enemy, which we had in the communist system, tracking down enemies, those who were serving the imperialists, right, who were traitors to the communist cause, right? And here we also have, I would say, in liberal democracy, there is even a deeper sense of the enemy. You yourself mentioned the names I was called at Middlebury, but there are more words of abuse like this. So whoever conducts an intellectual inquiry has to be very careful not to commit an ideological sin, not to commit what George Orwell calls a thought crime, right?
Yes.
Well, I could go on and on, but this I could see it also in European politics too, and in European life, and to some extent it results from the capitulation of the conservatives of the political right, that the perhaps after 1968 it is the left that took over the political and the moral agenda in the entire Western world, and the political right somehow capitulated, withdrew, and they accepted the agenda of the left.
You've mentioned this capitulation of the right. That leads very deftly into my last question, because we have 2 minutes left, and I so wish we could talk longer. How do we prevent this incremental creep toward totalitarianism, understanding that many of us on the right capitulated too much and too early, and now we find ourselves fighting things like the politicization of toilets, for example, or that progressive ideological zeal that hinges on hate crimes that are also thought crimes? How do we prevent the creep for someone who is a mother who will eventually send my children to college? What can be done?
Well, first of all, I think parents should provide some kind of alternative cultural environment. And then I think what is important, what we should start with, inculcating the virtue of courage. I mean, do not be afraid. I mean, that should be the commandment or the principle. Do not be afraid of this pressure, and do not be afraid of all these accusations. Stand up against the ideologues who threaten you with all sorts of repressions. I mean, that's also my experience from the communist times. I mean, once you stand up against them, they will probably back down. I mean, they are afraid.
Professor
Riesgaard,
I wish we had more time, but Professor Riesgaard Lickow, who is from European Parliament, I could talk to you so long, but you have been an honored guest on Washington Watch today. You have been listening to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I have been Sarah Perry, Partnerships Director, sitting in for him today. Go to TonyPerkins.com for more information on today's guests. Follow him on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. And a reminder, go to NationalDayOfPrayer.org. We'll see you next time on Washington Watch.
6-6-3-7-2-7-2-3-4.